Good morning. We're so glad you joined us on this beautiful day. It's a great day to sit inside and read and to be with friends. My name is Carter Luke, and I am the CEO and president of the MSPCA Angel, and I am honored to be with you today and to be with these two incredible people who are some of the finest human beings, the most caring human beings, not only about animals, but about people as well. Of course, today we're going to talk about animals. I'm going to introduce them a little bit to you. I've known both of them for over 30 years. To my immediate right, probably doesn't need much of an introduction. This is Vicky Croak, one of the kindest, most humane people in the world, well known around the country as a reporter, as a writer, as an interviewer, and in my mind, as a peace-loving advocate for consideration of the planet, including animals. And it is really an honor to be sitting next to Vicky Croak. Vicky will be doing most of the interviewing today, but I wanted to let you know who it is that I'm honored to sit next to and who's joined us today. And to her right is our guest of honor today, and this is Cy Montgomery. Cy is someone I've also known for about 30 years as a human being and as an author. Actually, Cy wrote for the MSPCA Angels magazine, which was called Animals Magazine, which we published for 135 years. And in fact, I looked it up. You wrote 40 articles about us and about mostly about animals, a couple about us. There was an article you did about on some of the sadder sides of our work, cruelty and law enforcement investigation, but wrote also about the healing at Angel Animal Medical Center, but mostly about the world of animals and how we interact with them, and 40 stories. It's really amazing that we published. She is indeed an incredible human being as well as a great author. I want to let you know, too, that it was in the Boston Public Library in 2002 when we awarded Cy Montgomery with the Edward Hyde Cox Award. And this is a medal that is given to a person in the field of communication, journalism, or literature, who advances the well-being of animals and acknowledges the power and beauty of the relationship that humans share with them. So that was 2002 when we gave that award to her. Interestingly enough, Vicky was also awarded that for her work in journalism, the arts, and literature as well. So it is amazing to sit next to these two award winners. Speaking of Cy, she's written 21 books for both adults and children. They've gotten a lot of attention, a lot of honors. We're going to certainly talk about some of her latest book, How to Be a Good Creature. There's no better teacher than the two people to my right. And these are people who indeed support a peaceful world, and we happen to do it with our love for animals. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce Vicky, who will proceed with the welcome.
Thank you.
We are so happy to be here today. Thank you for coming. And Luke, Cy and I just found out this morning that Luke was going to be here and introduce us. And I wish there were a film of me getting the phone call at home and saying, Luke Carter! And Carter Luke, sorry. And I'm too excited. He goes by, his name is Carter Luke, but he goes by Luke.
Yes.
And so I tried to call Cy on her cell phone, who was coming down, to say, it's Luke who's going to introduce us. So I want to say that we're going to have Cy the Incredible do a little reading from her book, How to Be a Good Creature. Then we're going to talk to her a bit, and we persuaded Luke to stay up here with us because, obviously, this is an extremely happy little group and with lots to say about animals. But I don't want you to worry, because what's going to happen is you're going to hear some incredible stories about animals and our connection to them from Cy and from Luke, and then you're going to be thinking about stories about your own animals or have questions, and I'm going to really make sure that we have enough time to come out and hear from you. So, Cy, have you picked... I've been arguing with Cy all morning about the reading, just because she doesn't want to take up too much time reading, but you want to hear some of this book, right?
Great. Well, I'm going to begin at the beginning. Thank you so much, both of you. It is such a treat to be here with you, and particularly you two. So here we go with chapter one, which is titled Molly. because this is a memoir in 13 animals, and the first animal who you meet is Molly. As usual, when I was not in class at elementary school, we were together. Molly, our Scottish Terrier, and I were doing sentinel duty on the spacious crew-cut lawn of the General's House, quarters 225, Fort Hamilton, Brooklyn, New York. Rather, Molly was keeping watch, and I was watching her. Unfortunately for Scotty, bred to hunt down foxes and badgers, far too little prey was to be found on the orderly and efficient army base. Every inch was strictly manicured, and wild animals were not tolerated. Still, because Molly did find the occasional squirrel to chase, and because though we lived there, the home was not ours but the U.S. Army's, and we couldn't put up a fence, she was chained to a sturdy corkscrewing stake driven deep into the ground. I watched her scan the area with her wet black nose and her pricked swiveling ears, longing as I did daily to smell and hear the invisible comings and goings of distant animals. And then she was off like a furry cannonball. In an instant, she had ripped the foot-and-a-half-long stake from the ground and was dragging it and her chain behind her as she charged, snarling with gleeful fury, through the yew bushes in front of the single-story brick house. Quickly, I glimpsed what she was chasing. A rabbit. I leapt to my feet. I had never seen a wild rabbit before. Nobody had ever heard of a wild rabbit on Fort Hamilton. I wanted a closer look. But Molly had chased the rabbit around to the front of the house, and my two weak second graders' feet, imprisoned in their patent leather Mary Janes, couldn't carry me nearly as fast as Molly's four clawed, fully mature paws. A Scottish Terrier's fierce, deep voice is too commanding to be ignored. Soon, from out of our quarters, came my mother and one of the enlisted men who'd been assigned to help keep the general's house tidy. A forest of legs exploded around me as the adults zigzagged after our furious terrier. But, of course, they couldn't catch her. By this time, Molly had broken free of the chain and left the stake behind. There was no stopping her. Whether she caught the rabbit or not, she'd be out for hours, perhaps till after dark. She'd come back, signaling at the door to be let in with a single summoning woof, only when she was good and ready. Though I wished I could have run after her, it wouldn't have been to stop her. I wanted to go with her. I wanted to see the rabbit again. I wanted to learn the smells around the post at night. I wanted to meet other dogs and wrestle and chase them, to poke my nose into holes and smell who lived there, to discover treasures hidden in the dirt. Many young girls worship their older sisters. I was no exception. But my older sister was a dog. And I, standing there helplessly in the frilly dress and lacy socks in which my mother had dressed me, wanted to be just like her. Fierce, feral, unstoppable. And this I grew up to be. In my work, I've had the pleasure of meeting pink dolphins in the Amazon. I've been able to swim with wild octopuses and meet other captive octopuses who recognize my face and reach their arms up to cover my skin with their suckers. I've been able to track snow leopards in the Gobi and lie down beside cheetahs in Namibia. And I've had the chance to be all over the world. I got to work in the largest snake pit in the world with 18,000 snakes. I've been lucky enough to handle a wild tarantula in French Guiana. I've gone to Sunderbin, where tigers swim out after your boat and get on board and eat you. Which they did not, because they are, as I told my husband, man-eaters, honey. The women stay home where they can be eaten by crocodiles. and dive in cages while great white sharks swim around and look benignly at the funny bubbling people inside. I have had a dream life so far, and I'm not even done. I'm just 60. So, but it was Molly who showed me what I would do with my life. But, you know, you can't go to college and major in jungle exploration. So the next chapter I'm going to read just a little bit from, and then we can get down to talking, is about more teachers who I met, and these in Australia. And chapter 2 is titled, with their names, Bald Throat, Black Head, and Knackered Leg. Knackered is more impolite than I knew at the time. Alone with the wind and the dry wintering scrub, I was squatting in a sea of thorny ground cover in the middle of the Australian outback. And then suddenly, I knew someone was there. I was 26, 5 years out of college, and literally half a world away from home, which most recently had been New Jersey, where I'd worked for 5 years as a science and environmental reporter for a daily newspaper. But now, I was sampling small plants for a graduate student's botanical survey. The only sound, other than my knife cutting the stems, was the wind blowing through the low bushes and stunted eucalyptus trees called mallee, until something jerked my mind away from my work. I looked up to see three giant birds, each as tall as a man, strolling casually through the brown grass, not 15 feet away from me. They were emus, nearly 6 feet tall, typically 75 pounds. These flightless birds stand beside the kangaroo on Australia's coat of arms as a symbol of this otherworldly continent at the bottom of the globe. Emus seem part bird and part mammal, with a little dinosaur thrown in. Shaggy twin-shafted brown feathers hang from the rounded torso like hair. A long neck periscopes up from the body, ending in a goose-like beak. The wings are mere stumps and stick out from the body like comical afterthoughts. But on their strong, backwards-bending legs, emus can run 40 miles an hour and sever fencing wire or break a neck with a single kick. At the sight of them, a shock leapt from the top of my head down my spine. I'd never been so close to this large wild animal before, much less while alone on a foreign continent. But I was not so much afraid as I was dazzled. I froze, caught by their grace and power and strangeness as they lifted their long, scaly legs and folded their huge dinosaurian toes and then set them back down again, balletically dipping their necks into an S shape as they picked at the grass. They walked past me and then over the ridge. Finally, their haystack-like bodies blended into the round, brown forms of the wintering bushes, and they were gone. After they left, I felt a shift in my psyche, but I had no idea that I had just caught the first glimpse of a life farther off the beaten path than I had ever imagined. I could not have known it then, but these strange giant birds would grant me the destiny that Molly had inspired, and they would repay me a millionfold for my first act of true bravery, leaving all that I loved behind.
That was beautiful. And you know, it's one of the things that I really remember about talking to you about the emus long ago was your definition. I thought this was so perfect because Sai said to me, and I think that it's in your book too, that you were chasing these birds. I'm going to let you tell it because it's really funny. But you had never felt, she's out in the outback without access to bathrooms, et cetera, and you said you had never felt more beautiful in your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what, I mean, that's love. That's love. That's the definition.
That's what love does for you. Yeah, absolutely.
And if I can't get you to say it, I will. That she said her hair was matted like a dog's. And, and she thought, oh, that's what.
It was great. And, you know, you couldn't shower. There were no mirrors. You were probably stinky. I know I looked scary. But, you know, to an emu, I looked just fine. And because, you know, they let me into their lives. They let me into their wild lives, and that bestows a grace upon you and a beauty upon you that I'd never really felt before. In their eyes, I was beautiful.
One of our colleagues from the Globe, Louise Kennedy, was looking at a picture of me with a giant panda, and she said, I know that look. And she wasn't talking about the panda. It was that same thing that you were feeling. I want to say that we are such a happy trio here because we obviously didn't know that Luke, I said before, we didn't know that Luke would be here, but I remember so vividly the first time I actually met Cy, and it was at the MSPCA, and it was at your theater, which still runs. It's a dark, sort of old-fashioned, almost like a cinema, the steep steps, and even though Cy and I were both writing about animals for the Boston Globe, I hadn't met you yet. In fact, I thought, who is this guy, Cy Montgomery, who's doing the animal stories I want to do too? And she was down at the podium, and she had written her book, The Spell of the Tiger, about the man-eating tigers of Sunderbend. And we were so rapt in the audience because you spoke a little bit at the beginning, in this hush about these massive, beautiful, silent tigers that would plink people off of a boat, and you found beauty in it, and we were so, all of us, so stunned. And that was it 30 years ago that we?
Oh gosh, that yeah, we were in that dark book. That was my second book. But now you're going off to meet lions in India. So
I have to stop her again. When she starts to talk about me, we'll just everyone say boo, so that we can just focus on the right stuff here. There is goodness in the world, and your thoughts and stories, and Luke, your work, help us tap into it through nature. God, we need it right now, don't we? Wild nature, human nature, and the connections, really, the complete, undivided bond between us and them. How is it that animals make us human? Are the lessons about life, our own lives, from them? I believe you defined it in terms of compassion, and especially in this book, how compassion is made possible by getting inside the minds and hearts of another, and we are animals too. Tree kangaroos, cheetahs, octopuses. So let's start with how a 750-pound pig named Christopher Hogwood taught you that kids are fun. That's something even when you were a kid, you weren't so sure of.
Absolutely. Gosh. Well, Christopher Hogwood came home in a shoebox. He was so little. And he was the runtiest pig among a whole bunch of runts. He was growing up on a farm where his brothers and sisters were destined for the freezer. But since he was going home with a vegetarian and a Jew, he was going to be totally safe. But my husband and I had no idea how to raise a baby pig. We didn't know how big he'd get. We didn't know how long he'd live. We'd never really had a close friend who was an ungulate, in fact. Everybody had been a carnivore, or they'd been a bird, or they'd been a reptile. So we just didn't know. But boy, he thrived, and in no time he'd grown to 750 pounds and become this like celebrity in our little town of 1,500 people. And what he did for me, he did so many things for me. One, he taught me about family. When we got him, my family had recently disowned me for marrying my husband. They didn't like him because he was Jewish. After my father died, many years after my father died, I discovered what my mother did not know, and that my father was Jewish. So that whole thing was bizarre. He showed me that you build a family not out of blood, not out of, you know, picking the right sex, age, class, religion, people, and your genetically related children, but you build a family out of love. And we built a multi-species family out of love, and the children were to come, although not in the usual way. My husband and I, mostly me, had decided very early on that we weren't going to have children, but the children came because we had a pig. And it started with the little girls who moved in next door to the empty house, who were renting there because their mom and dad were getting a divorce, and they were forced to move from their natal home, which they loved, which was elsewhere in Hancock, to this cold 200-year-old house where they didn't want to live, until they looked up and saw next door a great big spotted pig. And I was feeding Christopher and petting him, and I looked up and saw these adorable kids, I think 7 and 9 or maybe 7 and 10 at that time, come rushing over. And we didn't even have to say hello before, you know, I was showing him all the spots that he liked to have rubbed, and we were feeding him chocolate donuts, and then the next thing you knew, we were having pig spa, and all the kids in the neighborhood were coming over. And pig spa was totally awesome. Because you got to wash a giant 750-pound pig, and he loved it, and he would give these, like, happy grunts, unless the water was too cold, and he would leap up and shriek like he was being butchered. But he brought all these children into my life, and even as a child, because I was an only child, and I'd lived on the Army base, and I was the general's daughter, I really didn't have friends who were children, because if you're the general's daughter, nobody wants to send their kids over, because if they cong you on the head with their little truck, you know, the next thing you know, your dad is doing KP duty. So, but that was fine with me, because all of my friends were like bees and crickets and Molly and Jerry and Bluebell and my turtles, and they were all animals. But it wasn't until Christopher Hogwood that I found out how much fun kids were and how much we had in common. And you met Christopher.
Yes.
And he was a great guy. I mean, you can see why he always got write-in votes in town elections. In fact, I mean, I think right at the election coming up right now, even though he is a pig and dead, he...
There's so much to say about that, right? But... I have to ask you, and what I'm going to get you in on is talking about compassion a little bit in our bonds, but first I'm going to ask Cy about the title of this book, which is a little disingenuous on my part, because she's going to try to credit me with it, but what I really want to know about
but it's
is not the part where you're going to say the thing about me, but how is it that you're telling, how did you choose, your life has been full of creatures. How did it come to be 13? And you can tell little bit about
okay, this. I'm sorry. Well, okay, this book exists because of Vicky Croak, and also my previous book exists because of Vicky Croak. Honest to God. But, all right, I won't even talk about the previous book, which is called Tamed and Untamed, with my co-author, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, foreword by Vicky Croak. But we won't mention that. But this book, How to Be a Good Creature, it was not my idea. It was not... And because it wasn't my idea, I didn't know what title the non-idea was going to have. Vicky and Kristen came to our house in Hancock, New Hampshire, to do an interview for The Animalist, which was
the title of their BR blog.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. And after we'd walked around in the woods with Sally and played with the chickens, and then she interviewed me. At the end of the interview, she said, "Well, what have these animals taught you, not just about their lives and their natural history, but what lessons can you take away for your life because you've known them?" And I said, "How to be a good creature." And one of the editors at Houghton Mifflin happened to see this thing, which was archived, the show was archived on the web, and she said, "This has got to be your next book." So I wrote it. It's a memoir in 13 animals. So you're right, it was really hard to pick the 13 individuals because every animal has given me so much. And there's animals who I left out, whose love informs my every breath and everything I write. But I chose these 13 because the lessons that they taught me about my life are lessons that I thought my readers would would be facing the same things. These are animals who help me find and follow my destiny. We all do that. They helped me found and nurture a family. And we all do that, whether we're married with children or not. They help me cope with loss and despair. They help me find the enchantment in daily life and help me to fall in love with life again and again. So I picked the animals, the 13 animals, who help me do that. So they are a number of dogs, a pig, an ermine, 2 tree kangaroos, 3 emus.
Are you cheating and looking at the picture?
I am looking at the picture. I'm totally. I mean, that's the cheat.
We're seeing the image. I think that's up here, Daniel.
Yeah. It's a beautiful cover. I love the cover of the book. And I just met the artist when I was in Nashville on book tour. Anyway, so and they're the ones I owe for teaching me those lessons at critical turning points in my life. And it's my hope that their spirits will reach out to my readers as well. So I did not want to write a memoir. I'd written a memoir before, which was called The Good, Good Pig, and it was the story of Christopher Hogwood. And I didn't want to write about my childhood, for example. I've never written about my childhood. I didn't want to write about a period of my life where I was very unhappy and depressed, but I did so to honor these animals and out of affection for my readers.
And I'm going to ask you a little bit about that in a second, and also I'm going to make Luke talk about in the next section. But, you know, one of the things that's funny to me is, as you're saying about your family, years ago there was a survey from the American Pet Association or something like that, and people were shocked by the finding that of married respondents, I think it was specifically, that something like 75 or 80% of them greeted the dog when they got of dog owning couples, that they greeted the dog before their significant.
Well, who's at the door? Who's at the door?
Naked, wearing only a collar. It would do much for couples if your significant other ran to the door wearing only a collar, saying, "You're home. My life is complete."
Right.
I don't know. That shouldn't have been a shock to anybody.
Check your cell phone pictures and count how many pictures there are of your spouse or partner and how many there are of your emu.
Everyone. I want to talk about, with both of you, a little bit. It's funny, our society obviously is has very different views, sometimes held simultaneously, about our relationship with animals. So we like to call things anthropomorphism, and one of the things that everyone's talked about, is the way we use language, and since we're at the book festival, to separate ourselves from creatures. So humans speak, animals vocalize. We love, they bond. We form friendships, they maintain social bonds. We feel jealous, they resource guard. We have sex, they copulate. There's a little pattern here. So as we're determined to separate ourselves from the rest of the animal kingdom, even if we have to cheat, which is totally what's happening, and sometimes it does sound like cheating because while scientists... So what do we see in scientists? And it just continues. They're piling up the evidence documenting how much we share with other animals. Emotionally, cognitively, neurochemically, many humans still use outdated linguistic distinctions that put animals in their allegedly inferior place. And a while back, Sai, I asked you about it because you've never fallen for it. And this is a quote from you. Maybe this will be your... No, this was this. We talk about being anthropomorphic, you said, about attributing human traits to animals. Who says those traits are human? Who said we came up with them? Evolution says we did not come up with them. Evolution says we inherited them.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, whether you understand evolution or even if you accept the creation stories that almost every culture has, People don't just appear on the earth de novo. And it's useful to have love. You know, our emotions are useful. Fear is a useful thing. Feeling joy is a useful thing. And we know that every single neurochemical that we have looked for, the scientists have looked for across taxa is present. Even, oxytocin, the cuddle hormone famously that causes us to not leave our newborn at the bus station the first time we have to change the diaper. I mean, it's because hormones are there, the neurochemicals are there to create those bonds. Social bonds are important for organisms in general, and even octopuses, who are generally solitary and who generally they care for their eggs, but then the last thing the mother octopus does is blow her infants just hatched out of her lair. They have a form of oxytocin, so like oxytocin that actually one of the functions of oxytocin is to facilitate milk letdown. And let me tell you, there's no milk involved with octopuses, slime, but not milk. It's called cephalotocin. So, and this is something recognized by the neurobiologists who all signed in 2012 the Cambridge Agreement on Consciousness, the Declaration on Consciousness, that all mammals and birds and probably many of the invertebrates have the neural substrate necessary to generate consciousness. So, when years ago my editors, and you've had this too, my editors, I would write, the crane laid an egg and then she, and then they'd cross that out and write it. Well, she laid an egg. It's pretty obvious what sex the animal is. But no, you can't even have a sex even though an egg just came out of you. I mean, if that doesn't give you a right to have a sex, nothing does. But Animals Magazine always understood and never made animals its.
Have you? Yes, good. I want you to talk a little bit about that, and also you've seen society change in the language used. And
well, it's interesting. When I first saw the title of your book, for example, I found myself thinking, the word how to be a good creature. This is not just good creatures. It could have been titled that. And in fact, I wasn't sure if it was about how these particular 13 animals were good creatures, or whether or not this was a lesson for all of us, or a lesson for you about how to be a good creature. And when I think of it that way, I think we all talk about how animals teach us compassion and responsibility and all of those things. I certainly remember I grew up with animals and dogs and cats and some cows and horses, and there was a horse that taught me something very different to recognize. In fact, I have to admit, I was riding on a horse without a saddle, and the horse stopped, and I nearly fell off, and I was holding onto the horse's neck, and I was upside down. And I was thinking, whoa, this isn't what I saw on TV, right on top of horses. And then I recognized that horses were not dogs, were not cats. And that, in fact, we often view them because our experiences with companion animals and the animals that we grow up with. But sometimes we have to recognize they're very different. And they think different, communicate differently. And in fact, to me, the learning of respect for that difference and that compassion. And when we talk about how animals enrich our lives, I think the best thing that's happened in the world, to answer your question, Vicky, is that compassion and enrichment has started to move towards the recognition that the world is filled with different kinds of things. And the respect for those different kinds of things isn't about how it impacts on us, but in effect, having that respect result in your work, result in your life and how you interact with the planet, whether it's air or water or animals or fellow human beings. And that's why I say it's all about world peace. So when I look at your book that I'm going to acknowledge, I haven't read, but I want to read it because to me it's all about how do we be more respectful? How do we not view things through our own ears, our own experience, and our own evolution, but recognize, as you say, that don't let language define our outward respect for the rest of the world. So I think we're so much better because we're learning what respect for others really means. Mm.
It really enlarges your capacity for compassion.
Yes.
And it's great to know somebody who's not just like you. I mean, they may have emotions as you have emotions, but they are happy because they just killed something with their face. Now, you know, they're happy because they can taste you through their skin. They are happy because they're singing with their knees. You know, they have these abilities. Like Henry Beston said in The Outermost House, one of my favorite books, you know, they are living by voices we cannot hear. They are not brethren, they are not underlings, they are other nations. And they expand our experience of the real world by the senses that we have lost or never attained. And they make us more at home in this vast world because we can access that vast world by being friends with them or just admiring them, just watching them, just having them on the planet. You don't have to meet a wild octopus to benefit from the presence of these creatures on the planet. Even animals whose species have not been named enhance our world in so many ways. And so we lose directly when we lose any of that diversity. And that is true of diversity within the human family as well.
So beautifully put. And, you know, I was thinking of Boswell. For the Boston Globe, I wrote a story about Boswell, a goose who had bone cancer and was being treated at Tufts Vet School. And the day that I went up there, I knew all about animals, that I loved animals, but this was an anomaly. Everyone was telling me up there, you should really meet Boswell. And I went into their oncology suite, which is like a human oncology suite, except that there was a Toulouse gray goose on some newspaper. And I got there as his dad, Mark, arrived to pick him up. And all of the people who treated Boswell said to me, you're so lucky you're going to be here when he sees Boswell. And so they opened the doors to the oncology unit, and the hallway was crowded outside. And they said, Boswell, your dad is here. And so his head swiveled up, and he starts coming down the hallway, and his feet, they were slapping the tile floor, reminding me of my grandfather's slippers. And he's making his way through this crowded hallway, and he was sort of talking to himself in a goose way. And then he saw Mark, and he picked up speed, and he ran to Mark, and Mark knelt down, and Boswell threw his head back and was honking, honking, honking with joy. And it's you can't be, like, I've never been an objective reporter for this stuff. I'm crying in the hallway thinking about this. This is the definition to me of love and friendship, and I also think about, and I want both of you, if you can, and I want to get, I'm so sure that you have questions for these guys. When I was growing up, I had a little mutt named Penny. And my sister, I have one sister, and we would play with a family of kids down the street. And our dogs played together, too. So Penny was good friends with Cleo, their dog. And over time, the humans and the families just grew apart, but the dogs remained friends. And in Framingham, where I grew up, there was no leash law at the time, and so Cleo was kind of a pointer dog, would come, she had a heavy tail, and she'd come, she'd continue to come to the house, and her tail would bang on our screen door, and we'd let Penny out to play, and they'd go off into the neighborhood and play. And so after my sister and I were no longer playing with the Morrises, that the dog's friendship continued. But our dog Penny died at 16. I was 16, and she was 16. And about a week after Penny died, there was a bang at the door, and there was Cleo. And I can't even tell the story now without getting so emotional. And so we thought, what do? We just, instead of letting Penny out, we let Cleo in. And she saw that. So to me, all through, and I'm certain that you all have stories like that too, but you have been friends with animals. They've taught you about friendship. And not even, I mean, in the way that you were, and Luke, I know that you have these stories too, that it's not just, oh gosh, I learned to be nice to an animal, but I think they really deeply teach us to be good creatures.
absolutely.
So have you learned everything you need to know about being a good creature?
I fail miserably at being a good creature all the time, but at least I know what it looks like or what can look like because I have had such good teachers. And that's the thing. I mean, I've kind of lived my life according to this, this saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. But the thing is, the teacher is not necessarily in front of the classroom and doesn't necessarily have two legs.
Nice. That's beautiful. Now, as sort of promised, though a little late, I'm sure that there are questions that, and please feel free to ask anyone up here except me. Ask these two. What can I do to help? I'm never a good facilitator. I've put everyone on the spot. Is there something I didn't get at before, by the way?
No, everything's perfect. You're perfect.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Hi. How long did it take you to write down all 13, roughly?
To write the entire book? Oh, boy.
Well, a lifetime, right?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the research was already pretty much done. So when did I start writing? It probably took about 9 months to write it. But it was painful and scary writing it. I did not want to revisit my childhood. There's some dark stuff, not a lot of it, but there's. I just make mention of it. Molly actually probably saved my life, and there was another point that was very dark, and I didn't want to revisit that, but I did so, and I'm glad that I did. But you know what? When I wrote the book about Christopher Hogwood, I was miserable writing that, too, because I had just lost him. I'd lost him, and I'd lost Tess, and you'll read in this book how hard that was and how depressed and miserable I was when I was writing that. And when I was writing this, I knew everything was going to come out all right because I had a puppy, which is the cure for everything. And he's the last chapter of the book, and I can't wait for you to meet him. If you read the book, you'll meet my little guy. He's a one-eyed border collie. His other eye doesn't work, so I say he has one blind eye, one good eye, and one blessed eye. The blind eye is what brought him to me. And he can't herd. He's a border collie, but what he can do is canine freestyle dancing. So even though we purposely didn't have children, I'm still taking him to dance lessons, and I'm driving him to play dates, and I'm always hiking in the woods with him with other dogs, and oh my gosh, life is so great. I'm so happy.
I once wrote about that freestyle dancing with dogs, but
yeah.
I always thought, you know, we did it when we were younger too, but it resulted in my mother saying, "Leave that poor dog alone."
Well, he likes this. He likes it. In fact, I've seen video of us dancing together, and he's just looking at me. He's like, "What next? What next one?" I did not even realize how much he was enjoying it until I saw the video and I could see his face.
Luke, among the many things that you guys do at MSPCA, losing a pet is a particular specialty in helping people through. My wolfhound died probably 8 months ago, and poor Cy call her all the time, crying and. How is it that how do we help people through? Please tell me because I'll start up again. But it's something, if you love animals, you experience loss. And
yes. This happens to be the second anniversary of Teddy, and October 13th is a special day for me. And I think everybody's a little different. Not only is everybody different, but for me, every loss has been felt differently. And a lot depends on what else is going on in my life. And the support network that we have that could be four-legged or furred or finned or two-legged is really important. I think, so I know at the MSPCA Angel, we do have people who specialize in helping people navigate through quality of life decisions, whether it be an oncology case or approaching making a difficult decision or afterwards. There's a lot of services available for people. I think one of the things that we're starting to learn is how animals go through a sense of loss. Is we were talking about that earlier, and I know to this day, one of my cats still goes to that door that Teddy used to come in and out of. And I'm never quite sure whether or not Lunar is sad or what the emotion is that he's feeling, but he knows that something's not right, and his friend that he used to sleep with for 14 years isn't there anymore. And there's an element of, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if a tear came down, but that's really being anthropomorphic. There's certainly, we're learning more and more about how incredible the, if you will, emotions of animals are, and how deep they are and how complex they are. It's just sometimes hard for us to see. So I've been spending a lot of time reading and learning more about that aspect of loss in terms of how animals deal with it. And dogs are different than cats, of course, and horses are different than pigs. But a really fascinating topic.
And hard to go through.
Hi. So being 12, I have no consideration yet. I'm not deciding anything yet. But like, if you are going to work with animals, which I definitely want to do when I grow up, what would you study? Would you study like biology, zoology, any kind of ology? What kind of ology would you study? That's my question.
Okay, I think that's a great question. We could both answer that from different perspectives, and I can start, because the great news is, whatever talent you have, no matter if it is athletic ability or if it is the ability to sew or foreign languages or math or science or writing or art, you can bring it to the table to help animals. And that part of that is because animals do need so much help in this world, because their voices are not heard, even though most of us on Earth are animals. Well, there's plants, and then there's the fungi, most of us aren't human. But, I mean, the path that I took, I thought when I was little that I would be a veterinarian. But then I began to read. And my father, who was my hero, was always reading the New York Times. What was he reading in the New York Times? He read for me the animal stories. And I'm 60 years old, so I'm reading in the 60s, 1960s. All the animal stories were about deforestation, human overpopulation, cutting, animals being killed by hunters, poaching, pollution, I mean, all of this stuff. And that's when it occurred to me that as a veterinarian, I could do wonderful things in the world. I could heal sick animals. But as a writer, I could do that too. I could help in that way. So when I went on the tree kangaroo expedition, for example, you'll read about in the book, and they are really kangaroos who live in the trees. They're not like prairie dogs that aren't really dogs. These are actual kangaroos. And they jump down out of the trees and boing away, just like the other species of terrestrial kangaroos. On our expedition, we had 42 people. Many of them were folks from the local village in Papua New Guinea, but we also had an artist on that expedition. We had a photographer on that expedition. We had a veterinarian on that expedition. We had a writer on that expedition. We had a zookeeper on that expedition. And the rest were scientists. So you don't even have to be just a scientist. So that's what I would have to say. And Luke, I'm sure you have a lot more to add.
Well, I really like the photography one, because that really, once you get used to, you're observing is what you're doing. I know for me, I was real interested when I was 12 years old. I had the same kind of thoughts. I'm going to say I studied in the creek that ran behind our house. I spent a lot of time getting muddy and playing around with that creek. But I also happened to go to a university because I was thinking, maybe I want to do this for a living. And I happened to go to a university where there were classes in ichthyology and mammalogy and ornithology and limnology and the study of lakes and life in lakes. And I found that absolutely fascinating, because I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a veterinarian or a scientist, and I ended up being an elementary school teacher, which to me was the same thing. And then I worked in an animal shelter, which to me was the same thing as being an elementary school teacher, and then I ended up at the MSPCA, which was the same thing. But I enjoyed the intellectual challenge of learning what makes up a fish. How do fish not go all to the bottom? How do they not float to the top? And understanding the differences just in the science of what a fish is, to me, was really a valuable learning experience. So I like your question.
Yeah, it's a really smart question. And what I did in college, I triple majored and wanted a fourth one that wouldn't let me do it, because everything I learned from physical fitness to language skills to I've used that to help animals. Just being a writer, you know, for physical fitness, you gotta learn to scuba dive and ride camels and hike for hours and tread water, and you know, you need to learn foreign languages to go to Papua New Guinea and French Guiana and, you know, places in Africa, so on and so forth. So everything you learn, you can use. No matter what your major is, you'll use it. All my Girl Scout skills, very, very helpful. So, you know, every chance you can get out into the world with animals, wild and domestic, will help you too. And you will be helping them meanwhile.
So one of the greatest advocates for animals in this room is this lady. So what's your advice? How do you learn about animals? How do you make a decision about how you can have an impact on the world if you were 12 years old?
Oh, if I were 12 years old. Do you know, I think things are so much better now. When Cy and I are exactly the same age. When we were growing up, not only were there very few professions for people who loved animals, but very few genders. It was boys and men who were, we thought, veterinarians, field biologists, and that all of that stuff started to change. And as we grew up, we, just as you said, there are, if you love animals, there are a million things that you can do from whatever your expertise is. So follow your passion. And even starting out in newspapers, we have had a very similar path. I had always wanted to be a field biologist. I wanted to be, because we had Jane Goodall's books were just coming out at that time. And so I want to say, too, that I was diagnosed with lupus when I was a teenager. And, you know, medicine was very enlightened at that time. Our doctor said, you'll never be healthy enough to go to Africa. So, of course, the first time I was in a Jeep in the Ngorongoro crater with my head popped out of there, I was like, yes, I was healthy enough to go. But just follow what it is that you love to do. And all those roads, even in the Ngorongoro crater, will open up before you. So I'm certain from how articulate you were standing up, and that you will find the right path, and the animal world, including humans, will be lucky for that.
And 80% of graduating veterinarians right now are females.
That's right. Yes. I forgot it. That's right.
So, great progress.
Last question. We have the person.
I don't know if I was prepared to be the last question. but I was wondering, which creature made it into the book that you were surprised made the cut, and which creature didn't end up in the book that you wish could have?
Well, I mean, I was the one that made the choices, so let's see.
Could you have had 14 creatures?
Well, my editor wanted more, and there were a lot of animals that I could have written about, like my first romantic love experience was with a parakeet, and he threw up on my finger, you know? I mean, he made love to my hand. And I was underage. I mean, anyway, he's not in there doing that. But it meant a lot to me. It meant a lot to me that he had picked me as his mate before I was old enough to pick a mate of my own. I was chosen by a parakeet. But I didn't write that because I felt like the 13 individuals who I picked covered what I thought readers might be facing themselves. I guess maybe one of the most surprising animals in that kind of roundup is Clarabelle, who was a pink-toed tarantula from French Guiana, and we met when she was living in a bromeliad, a potted plant, in the nature center where I was staying when I was working with Dr. Sam Marshall, who's probably the top expert on tarantulas. And she was a perfectly delightful little animal who we coaxed her out of the plant, and she was the first wild tarantula I'd ever held. And it was just like holding, you know, I don't know if you had a turtle when you were little, but many of the folks born when we were had turtle, and they'll just walk from palm to palm to palm, and it wasn't like, oh my God, big hairy spider walking on my hand. Instead, it was like little furry animal walking on my hand, and I felt this tenderness toward her, and it helped me feel that tenderness toward all spiders, many of whom are living in my bathroom because I never vacuum, and in the basement and in the barn. And the wonder of these creatures who wear their skeletons on their outside and whose sucking stomach is in their head and, you know, who can pull their injured leg off, eat it, and grow a new one. I mean, wouldn't you love to do that? It's so awesome. But, you know, Clarabelle showed me the wonder of the ordinary in that way. And that's something I think, you know, she helped re-enchant the whole world for me. So I think she might be one of the most surprising animals to be in the book.
Lovely. I want to say thank you to both of you. And I know we took you hostage a little bit, Luke, but you so enriched the conversation as you enriched the world of animals here and for people. And Cy, you guys, I feel so lucky to be sitting between the two of you. And thank you for this. Thank you for coming on a rainy day. Cy's book is available. I don't know where. We'll find out. In the back of the room.